and welcome to yet another edition of Hunter Gatherers, the podcast of Hunter S. Thompson stories, ladies and gentlemen. And always, as I am broadcasting from our historic studios on Magazine Street in New Orleans, I'm Christopher Tidmore, joined by our host on the lovely coast of Maine.
Curtis Robinson. And yes, good to hear your voice, and how you doing?
I'm doing well. And we got some interesting articles to talk about. We've been talking a lot about the 72 race in the last few things, but we haven't been talking about, we've been talking about what Hunter would have thought, WWHD, what would Hunter do? A lot of drugs. But the fact is, we haven't talked about what other people were seeing at Hunter and the fact that it took a little work to get Hunter to actually produce these columns. And we've got three columns, reporters who talk about that that period in Hunter's life, and then what happened subsequently about his activism, and that's kind of the subject of today's show. So other people,
yeah,
are talking,
you know, I would say I think we could call it premise envy. I think that when you start, I mean, let's face it, it was 50 years ago, right, when Fear and Loathing, the campaign trail 72. And when you look at it, you're like, all right, maybe, you know, sometimes I think it's maybe just us, right?
Yeah.
I think the when I steer people to read about Hunter and his prediction would be too strong, but his foreshadowing certainly of the race we have this year between Trump and Biden, and particularly when Trump was first elected. Seems like a millennia ago now, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. It's like, you know, when was Donald Trump? The transformation of the Republican Party. Everybody talks about the old Republican Party as if it's something that, you know, you're excavating with archaeologists, and you're saying to yourself, that was only like 8 years ago. It wasn't.
Yeah, last week, everything.
It's not that old. I mean, Nikki Haley is not like bringing back some 19th century tradition. This was, it was kind of what she was is what Republicans were prior to 2016. And, you know, anyway. Continue,
well,
please.
One of the things that I send people to is, and I guess today we're going to talk about a few articles, and I know I just sent you one that was more recent. I think it was last week, but I send people to a piece by in the Nation magazine by Susan McWilliams, Carrie McWilliams. Her grandfather was editor of the magazine from, I think, 50s into the 70s, and was relevantly assigned a young upstart reporter named Hunter S. Thompson the assignment to write about the Hells Angels. That story was where the book deal came from, and that's what put him into, and the Nation doesn't get enough credit for that. It was a crazy thing to do. But the granddaughter then writes a piece more recently for the Nation, and talks about how much Hunter forecast the rise of a certain kind of politics. And she makes a great case, and she was one of the more articulate people to do so. I mean, other people have done. I mean, the quintessential Hunter versus a certain kind of politics would be Freak Kingdom. But I think where McWilliams is really good is how much she gets to the point of Hunter's arguments about the left. And I'll just cue some of it up. It's like, you know, Thompson was not the only American writer to warn coastal left liberal elites about their disconnection from poor and working class white voters. Plenty of people issued such warnings. And she argues that it was one of the first, and you know, and in some ways, it is still the best psychological study of those Americans often dismissed as white trash or deplorables. And I think that his ability to spot that up and coming with, and use the Hells Angels as an example of it, of people who felt, as he would put it, they felt like they were strangers in their own country. And she really picked up on that. There are others who have made that argument, and certainly we have. But yeah, I think that's the reason people see so many connections between Nixon and Trump,
and of
in
course
the body politic,
and Nixon and Trump, and of course, you know, Wallace and Trump. It's interesting. I was looking at some statistics on the current race, and then I pulled up 72, and right now, according to polls both Rasmussen and a friend of mine, Ron Fosha, who used to be editor of Campaigns and Elections magazine, if you're familiar with CNE. Ron did a poll, and basically he's finding that hard support for Democrats, and particularly for Biden, amongst white Caucasians without a college degree is about 40%. The last time that happened, George McGovern was on the ticket. Even Michael Dukakis didn't fall that small. And so that now, in contrast, you know, college-educated people are, you know, have surged for the Democrats in ways it hadn't in previous decades. But the point of that statement is the coalition is being reflected. And a lot of, you know, Hunter talks about this. If you can't relate to people, you can't ask them to support you. I mean, he's very direct about that and what's happening in the campaigns. And, you know, it's, I think these articles are really, really get into that because it's one of these. I had a friend of mine, his father was a union man. He had been a banker for the unions. And he himself is very ardently, still very much involved. He'd been a Democratic Party official and a whole bunch. But he's a little bit different in that he's very economically liberal, but he's also, you know, a very devout Catholic. And, you know, he was talking about members of his own family who are, you know, now Ivy League educated and all this, three generations. And he I won't say who, but a very close member of his family, you know, called whites without college degrees working in trade professions deplorables. And he was like, wait a second, hold it. Let me explain this to you. That's your grandfather. And how fast the disconnect was about that, because they live in a bubble. And he said, and this particular person lived in a bubble in New York City and in academic, didn't know anybody who honestly didn't associate with anybody who didn't have at least a college degree, probably a graduate degree or beyond, and didn't understand. And he said, how fast have we gone in really less than two generations from that to, you know, to this? And he said, and he's a Democrat to this day, and he's all this, but he said, you know, it's very uncomfortable for me. You know, as somebody who grew up in the unions, who was a union official, is just to see that this is not something that, you know, that's respected.
You know, Hunter talked a lot in real time, not just in retrospect when we look at him and try to pull stuff out. He talked a lot about the contrast and how the what he would call the Berkeley elite were shocked when the Hells Angels turned out to be very different from them, and essentially they would have said turned on them, even though they had tried to champion them and to portray them as some sort of social cultural heroes. And he said that it's so interesting to look back at it, because he was talking about how dangerous that was, because it showed that they couldn't understand that the Angels were not their natural allies, and why they were not, and the fact that they felt that the elite part of the country had moved on from them, and more you see that. The other thing, of course, it's not necessarily pertaining to these writers, but the point Hunter would make about essentially the Hells Angels class of their feeling of total retribution and total attack, and, you know, attack on one is an attack on all. You see that portrayed as the, you know, Trump has many indictments, but his base does not change. And I think that's very telling about some of the stuff that Hunter was writing about 50 years ago. You see flashes of it after that. I think Reagan showed a few flashes of it, but you're really seeing it play out, the Wallace part of it to a degree. But, you know, Wallace was blatantly racist, whereas Trump has to be explained as racist. No one had to explain George Wallace.
No, I mean, George Wallace is segregation now, segregation forever. I mean, I watched, I am as people who listen to my political talk shows know, I'm a huge Trump critic. But I'm also somebody who's talking. I feel like my life is explaining liberals to conservatives and conservatives to liberals. And
many of us, Christopher, many of us feel that way right now. I'm like, you know, I tell people the radical center is about, you know, we could meet in an average size high school gym at this point.
Well, and I would say the whole comment about, you know, the mugshot comment, you know, the blacks love me because, you know, I'm being persecuted, and, you know, and I've had the racist amounts of that. And I said, honestly, it's not playing that way in the black community. It doesn't mean they love Trump, but there were some people who don't even like him who were kind of nodding at that. And I said, and one of the points about all of this, I got into this conversation. For those that don't know, I write for an African-American newspaper. I'm the associate editor of the Louisiana Weekly and have been for the last 27 years. And one of the, you know, I was watching this and I said, yeah, I know some of these things is kind of repulsive, but you're reacting like a white liberal would, as opposed to a lot of the way a lot of black people did. And I said, they're not, when it comes to immigration and other issues, Trump is kind of speaking what they've been saying for years. And that doesn't mean, look, I think there's going to be a huge African-American vote for Donald Trump, but it's harder to make the case against him. I mean, one of the points I point out is I said 25% of the black, you know, Nixon got 25% of the black vote. And it's everybody's astonished when I said that. I just said, no, I mean, Nixon originally got a large percentage of black vote. It was only really with the Southern strategy in the second campaign that it starts going away. But for the Republicans, but it's not like so far away in history. Things do change. And I'm watching this sort of change. The interesting part of this is the one constituency, and Hunter would have brought this up, that where 72 and the current race are, and the stories kind of reference this a bit, is nobody's really speaking for the Wall Street kind of conventional Republicans, and that's very Nixon versus McGovern. They both were kind of a little bit, you know, they kind of turned for the working class, and it switched back after that, and certainly Reagan was talking a lot more conventional economics. But when we've switched to the point where there's a lot of competition for the union vote, nobody really talks about, you know, where's suburban Wall Street, where's Bucks County going to be, where is in Pennsylvania, where is Long Island going to be, nobody, you know, or for that matter, where is you know, a suburban Virginia or something like that, suburban Milwaukee, suburban Chicago. It's one of those things where this has been kind of a working class versus a coalition fight, and that's very much like 72. So,
well, and of course, the warning rattle of that for those who would oppose Trump is that you know, as much as we remember Nixon a different way, he did win 49 states.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you do remember it was a landslide. So, like,
yes, that was not a particularly close election.
And
okay, I think that it's one of the things I love about it, of the articles that are coming up, and we should say that we'll put several of them on the website.
You will be able to read these. Curtis Robinson, give the three articles one more time, so people, because we've been jumping between the articles. What are the three articles?
Well, the ones that I would say the reading starts with the McWilliams piece in The Nation. I think that Freak Power, it's book length. And then I'm going to have to pause, unless you have it, to look up the author of the wonderful piece about Seal Rock Inn.
Oh, I've got it. Hold on a second. I'll pull it up in just a second.
It's nothing like having people on your podcast. Wait a minute, we'll read to you from the internet.
Yeah, it's you know, it's like one of those things where you go, when did I put it? We'll have it for you before the end of the show, folks. But
No. It appeared on San Francisco Gate. It was it's a culture piece. It's by Christian Baba, B-A-B-A. And it talks about 1973. I'm a big fan of the Seal Rock Inn. I'm a big fan of that piece.
Yeah.
And people will remember that he actually wrote about that, about writing that at that point.
And set up that, instead of that piece for a second, because what it is they Hunter's gone dark. They're not getting the column, so they send him out to do this, and he gets a hotel room next to him, and basically it's the carrot feeding of Hunter S. Thompson.
Yes, we've had other people talk about it before, but they talk about that. So his editor shows up as it says, there's 40 pounds of supplies, 2 cases of Mexican beer, 4 quarts of gin, a dozen grapefruits, 1 IBM Selectric typewriter, a few reams of paper, a hefty mass of firewood, and as Thompson later said, the most important ingredient of them all, will quote, enough speed to alter the outcome of 6 Super Bowls. And he stayed there for it, and it's great. They have fans will love this. It has pictures of the view from the room. It has what he saw from there. Points out the swimming pool, and so, a little bit of the history of the Seal Rock. I gotta say, I just loved it. It was the way of the era, you know, that special time and place to be a part of. And I just loved the piece. It was last week. You can find it with a simple search. It's got a couple of great pictures, but it's really gets into why Hunter was a big deal. I think it's one of the best new pieces I've seen in a while. It starts that it's hard to read Campaign Trail 72 and not see the parallels to today. Unpopular foreign wars. Rising cost, a Republican candidate who appeals to the darker instincts, and an aging Democratic establishment seen as increasingly out of touch. Well, you know, talk about premise envy. There you have it.
And
I think the writer, I think Christian, I don't know, also sort of nailed it when it said, even Thompson, I'll read from it. Even Thompson's internal conflicts feel familiar. With 2 historically disliked frontrunners, many people still wrestle with a hard choice. Why, Thompson wondered from his typewriter at the Seal Rock Inn, aren't Americans given, quote, a chance to vote for something instead of always being faced with that old familiar choice between the lesser of 2 evils? And that 2 evilism is a constant with Hunter, and I think... You know, the famous pollster Frank Luntz was saying last week that the party with the candidate that drops out and is replaced is the party that wins.
I mean, because I think everybody concentrated on the big news of the week being the fact the Supreme Court's going to review Trump's, you know, immunity thing in April, which means those different trials won't happen until the end of the year. Other than the Manhattan trial and the, you know, that he could get a major fine for silencing a porn star with campaign money, which in this day and age is it's amazing how far we have come on so many different issues. That used to be that was what killed Gary Hart. Not exactly that, but close enough to it. And but I'm watching all of this and I'm saying to myself, you know what's interesting about this? I watched an interview with Robert Kennedy because the other news is that he just got on the ballot in Georgia, Arizona, and about to be in Pennsylvania. And what is he running against? He's running against the war in Ukraine. That's one of his issues, the main issues. And I'm like, that doesn't seem like 72. That's certainly McGovern was that. It seems a little like 68, where the Democratic establishment doesn't want the guy who, you know, was running against the war to be the nominee. And, you know, so the, you know, it's one of those, it's whether you like RFK Jr. or compare him to his father or not, it's one of the subtexts the media is not catching up on. And it's actually encouraging a lot of young people to, that's the funny thing is there isn't a huge anti-war sentiment. Israel has kind of pushed it, whether, and I happen to support, you know, I think the difference between a Hamas and a Nazi is not very far, which I'm sure will get us mail, but I have all Jewish family members. But the fact is, those issues are so pushing it. It's a bit like not watching McGovern. It's a bit like watching, LBJ or Hubert Humphrey in this situation. Both sides are supporting the war, and it's disaffecting a lot of people. So, that's 68, sure, not 72,
We're here. We just came off the big protest vote in Michigan. But, I always say, this is essentially a general election kind of vote. Primary elections might be about voting for someone, but in my lifetime, general elections have always been about voting against someone. And I think that it's easy to make a protest vote when it's a protest vote with it's like those kids at, I think it was Harvard, that had the 12-hour hunger strike. I'm like, 12 hours is not a hunger strike.
Well, I mean, a 12-hour hunger strike.
Skipping a meal is not a hunger strike.
I mean, I do intermediate fasting when I'm disciplined. I'm not drinking, and I'm like, that's 16 hours. That's not a hunger strike. that's a lifestyle choice.
Not a hunger strike. That's intermittent. That's a great thing. That's not a hunger strike. That's intermittent fasting. But it's easy to make that. When they're staring down the barrel of an actual choice, it's hard for me to think that kind of numbers sit it out. And everyone, there's already the saying among Democrats, and I think it should be the posters, that, sitting it out or a protest vote is a vote for Trump. And that's what Hunter's talking about when he talks about the, voting for what you would perceive as the lesser of two evils. And I got to say, I think the biggest thing about the San Francisco game thing, I've not seen anything in a while that so reinforced, our point. And I always warn myself that I'm such a Hunter partisan and a fan that maybe I'm reading. So it's interesting when we see, we all love third party validation, don't we?
Yeah. I mean, I was reading that article. I was like, wow, it's really nice to read somebody saying everything that Curtis and I have said for 2 years on the podcast.
Yes. We all like that validation. But I think that's part of it. I think that this will, today we're coming up on Super Tuesday, so we might as well say this will be the, what can we say? We can say this is this the introduction to our summer of fear and loathing on the campaign trail. We're certainly set up. We're totally third party validated. We have sources. We're journalists. If we have sources, we have a story, right?
If we have sources, we have a story. And we're journalists enough to at least look for a source before we make up the story. Ladies and gentlemen, this, if there is a kickoff to this election year and looking at things through, fear and loathing to the campaign trail, 22 to 24. It's basically now. It's the Hunter diary of what would Hunter do in this basket case of an election, and comparing and going back to the book, to the original source material, and asking that question.
Yeah, we'll count this as the introduction, and chapter one will come out. We're on the cusp of Super Tuesday, which I think we know how that goes. And then yeah. I think it'll be there. I did want to ask you one thing. I know we're running out of time. Do you think Joe Biden debates Donald Trump in this election? Assuming things go the way they do, does he do that debate? Yes or no?
I don't. And the answer is, it normally I would respond yes, because the pressure will be overwhelming and Trump is going to want to challenge to debate an empty chair. What's interesting is that Trump will get blowback because he didn't participate in the debates. I actually think Joe Biden debates if there isn't real fear of it. Somebody asked me about, said Biden's mind is going on all this. I said, to use a 1970s comparison, I said, I've met Jerry Ford several times. He was a football player. In his 80s, he was one of the most agile people I knew. Yet everybody in 1975 and 76 thought the man was tripping off of airplanes. And I said, and that's, people voted for Carter on it. I said, if Biden can't do something that reassures the mental states, he's going to have to debate, because people will, it'll just, the crescendo of he's not mentally able to debate is going to be overwhelming. And, you know, Trump is going to say, I will debate an empty chair. And it's going to be too much. So, yes, I think there's going to be a debate. I think there has to be. There may not be like three or four. There may just be one. But there's going to be a debate.
I think so, too, for a lot of those same reasons and others. But I think there we have it. We didn't set out to do so among ourselves, but we have set issue. This is volume one, number one for here we go. The summer of loathing.
The summer of loathing, ladies and gentlemen, begins. Super Tuesday 1, March 5th, Super Tuesday 2, the 12th. And actually, if Trump doesn't get his 1,200 and some odd delegates, it's actually the Louisiana primary on March 23rd that may make up the difference. I had to bring it back home for a bit. So, but we'll post those stories.
That's true, isn't it? March 23rd might be the milestone.
That might be the milestone. It's because he comes close after Super Tuesday 2 on the 12th. It's theoretically possible. It was very, very difficult. If, you know, basically Nikki Haley would have to get no delegates in a divided field, and she is still pulling about a third of the vote. But by the time he gets to Louisiana, it's pretty much, it will decide, you know, he'll have the nomination officially, as not de jure. And so we'll see how that plays off. But as we do our next broadcast, we'll be fully into the general election season effectively. So we shall see. We shall see. On that note.
All right, with that.
Curtis Robinson, always a pleasure. Folks, we'll see you in the next edition of Hunter Gathers, the podcast of Hunter S. Thompson Stories.
Next week.
Well, the Southern gentleman hit the highway and gave us stories we could share of crooked schemes, shattered dreams of people everywhere. Road of whiskey screams and motel rooms where no one seemed to care. Road of deep, dark, secret places made us feel that we were